Confidence is everything else in your life. The 24 hours that you're not on stage. Like, I'm aware that back in the day, if self-sympathy is the way that I used to feel recognized, I would crave sad moments. Family is very silly, so I go into more absurd and silly spaces.
Yeah.
Music in school was my first stint with, let's say, any kind of recognition. If I make it about myself, then I am not doing justice to the entire ecosystem. Boy, I peaked in popularity in school.
Abhish Mathew is a storyteller, he's a comedian, he's so many things. But more than anything else, he's someone you can really learn from to understand what creativity truly is and how it's not just about you, it's about the people around you. Plus, how it's about how you channel many aspects of your mind which you don't talk about enough. My parents were actually super young when they had me. Parents got married at 16 and 20. Mm-hmm. My grandparents found out that they were dating and got them married. And then 4 years later, I was born. So 20 and 24, both were kind of studying, etc. So I still tell them, I said, we grew up together. Like, you know, yeah. I grew up at the same time. We were still in, literally exams, and I'm still this baby on the side, right? So that was that kid.
Mine's opposite because I was conceived at the age of 40 for both my parents. So for me, my parents are my grandparents. My elder brother is my parent, and I am the kid.
Yeah.
So you guys grew up together. I saw them grow up.
Yeah. And incidentally, for an everyone kind of thing, our audience is your parents today.
Oh,
your parents are here.
They're
sitting in to watch you do a podcast, and I'm really intrigued to see how this kind of goes. Does it stop you from saying things you wouldn't say?
Not at all. I think these guys have been very supportive of me on stage. So on stage with comedy, they become like the setup and punchline for my initial days of stand-up. So I don't know if they totally understand what I'm saying. They just laugh very supportively.
I'm whispering, they can still hear you. I'm just like, just like letting you
know. I mean, just take a look at this frame, okay?
Yeah.
My dad is on the left-hand side of a four-seater couch and my mom's on the right-hand side. They go for maximum comfort as opposed to proximity.
Which brings me to, firstly, welcome to Take a Pause. Happy you could do this. This is actually technically the first recording we're doing in this space that we have. And I want to kind of start off by asking, when you think back on you as a kid, what do you remember? As in, what are the first couple of things that come to your mind when you think of yourself as a kid?
One memory that is very clear is this going on stage for a fancy dress competition. And that had happened in church. So in church, we had fancy dress competitions where different people were coming and playing. So I dressed up as Mr. India. So it was just a little kid in like an underwear and a sash that said Mr. India. A small like light steel rod with like, I don't know if you remember the old flush.
Where
there'd be like this ball that... What is it called? Funnel.
The chain thing.
The chain thing. Like, you know, that black ball that rises.
It would rise up to... because you'd fill up.
Exactly.
And then if you didn't fill up quickly enough, you would go with a bucket of water and pour it in there.
Yeah,
it's taking too long.
So the black ball at the end of it, and all I had to do was hold it and go and perform. That's one of my first memories as a kid, especially with on stage. And in church, we used to have a lot of these acting competitions and all because we were an integral part of the community. So one of my first, I would say, proper images is them pushing me on stage and me performing, getting an applause and feeling, this is great. And I was very young.
You know, it's interesting you say that, right? And now, here's what my thought process is. When you said fancy dress competition, the first thing I remembered was, I'm in second grade. I get on stage, fancy dress competition. I bomb. So I go on dressed as a villager and I was going to do this whole monologue prep. Until then, I was that kid who parents come, anybody comes home, parents, friends, etc., come and perform. Costume changes would happen. That day, I walked on stage and my only line was, I don't want to do this. And I ran off crying. Didn't get back on stage for the next 15 years.
Are you telling me you and I had the same origin moment? But like Unbreakable, I go down Bruce Willis path and you go Samuel L. Jackson path. Oh, it's nice to see you.
But and that's interesting because, you know, I've spent a large part of the last many years in everything from therapy to coaching. I've spent a lot of time trying to understand my own mind. And what I've realized is you kind of can trace so many of your niggles and the way you are as a human being by going back to your childhood. I kind of go back to that point and I'm like, maybe that's where... So I've had like low self-esteem, low confidence and all for a large part of my life. And it's kind of come back now to later parts. I will far away.
Hard relate. Relating.
Because I was like, I think it in my head originated from there and then went, I mean, obviously things kind of added up as you kind of grow older. So my question to you is, because you did this hard relate, what is your, how do you feel about yourself in terms of self-esteem, confidence? Are those innately something you have? Because you're on stage all the time. So you are confident.
Yes, I would. It's an incredible, how do I put it? It's such an it's an incredible question you've asked, not as an interviewer, but somebody who also would relate with this as such. Like, I think we all go to therapy so that we are able to blame our parents or something.
Hmm.
But then after that, you come out of it thinking that, oh, actually, it's a product of something and we are the product of something else. So I would say since the very beginning, since I was put on stage, I'm very comfortable on stage. Hmm. Confidence has nothing to do with me on stage. When I'm on stage, I'm nervous. So then the excitement kicks in and then it's adrenaline and then you're in flow state.
Hmm.
Because if someone doesn't laugh, or back in the day when I used to do music, if one key goes off, or back in the day when my brother's a dancer, so he taught us how to dance. So even when I was dancing on stage, it's complete flow state. So I identify with what that feels like on stage. So confidence has nothing to do with it. Confidence is everything else in your life. The 24 hours or the 23 hours of your day that you're not on stage is where I battle with, let's say, confidence, self-esteem, or for that matter, a sense of visibility. Like, for example, I feel very visible on stage because I know I have command.
Mm.
But when I'm off stage, I don't know, I don't have a clear visual of myself.
Mm.
So I don't know if it's a confidence issue anymore because I've been going to therapy for many years now. And it's not a confidence issue anymore. It is a sense of personality. It has been ingrained for 35 years that I have to change it.
Yeah.
It is no more it's no more like a walking stick I need to depend on.
Yeah.
I need to pull myself out of it. Earlier, this lack of confidence leads into self-sympathy, and self-sympathy kind of is healing. But when that is the only healing you have, you get dependent only in that. So I want to make changes, and slowly I think the last couple of years I'm trying to make changes where self-deprecatory jokes were like completely on, like that's what I did.
Yeah.
But when I started going for a lot of shows, when writers were writing jokes, which is just roasts on me that I'm saying about myself, I'm like, I'll do that. Why are you doing it?
Yeah.
Not their fault, but that's the mandate that I set for like so many years. Now I'm trying to make fun of me. Yeah, exactly. Now it's like, I'll make fun of me. You laugh. You make fun of me, I'll also make fun of you to check that out. So to answer your question, I'm trying to get out of it.
Here's my build on that, right? Is that the assumption people have is that, okay, if I need to be a confident person, which means I need to be confident all the time, which is not necessarily true. I feel you kind of ebb and flow, right? Like you're on stage, you're confident. To get off stage, you might not it's almost like if you sometimes... You're in a crowd, normally you might not feel energized, but in a crowd on stage, you are energized. It's just that difference.
Yeah.
And people miss that and often say, no, but I'm not a confident person, so I might not be able to do this or I might not be able to do that. And I was reading something interesting the other day which said that there are things in our life that are energy boosting and there are things which are energy draining. So if you list out the activities, when you do innately, you feel like, but when you do, like, I do this any time of the day. And if you map them out, you actually find out what those are. And that's how you actually flow. What drains your energy?
Paperwork. Oh, flat out.
I agree. Oh, my God.
I would, this is my concept. I would work really hard and try to stitch money together just so that I can outsource paperwork to someone.
Yes.
And I have some really good friends who love paperwork. I know, weird people.
Do you file GST returns?
My friends do.
I do.
All right, so your fear isn't as...
No. I thank God I have an accountant, but that's a whole different... But I agree with you on paperwork.
You give. So as far as that's concerned, anything that drains energy is paperwork. Creatively, the thing that drains my energy is... if I'm doing a show in the evening, stand up, and if I don't have the full day just thinking about it, that's exciting. But what drains my energy is on that day, if I have some work call, even if one work call.
Oh, I agree.
Then I'm just like, what's the point? I don't have a flow. So it drains my energy to plan for stand up in the evening. But the couple of hours before I go on stage, your brain is automatically working. So I've made peace with the fact that you don't need 24 hours.
Yeah.
When you feel it, immediately write that down. And now it started happening before I go on stage a couple of hours before. So I sit down and I write. So what used to be draining, now I have made it into, no, I would much rather take a couple of, just a few hours before I go on stage.
Do you have like a ritual that you do, which kind of gets you into the zone?
When I go on stage, I want to carry a vibe and energy on stage, right? So that starts from what I'm doing before I go on stage. So if the green room is an active green room, and I will intentionally make it more fun. Everyone's silent. Everyone's very nervous about their stand-up set, especially when you're doing a couple of comedians collectively. So if you go and just converse a little bit, you see how the vibe, and that brings your mood up. And then when you go on stage, just carrying that energy off. So when I do any show that's mine, I fill the green room up with my friends. So yes, the one ritual that I do is that to make sure that the green room is really nice and bright. And I like talking most of the times. Second thing I do before I go on stage is, I think it's just an inculcated thing. Like I quickly make the sign of the cross and then I go on stage. So every time I do go on stage, I am kind of performing for the audience, but also in the back of my head for my family. Parents, brother, cousins, they all look, they're very interested in my career.
Yeah.
So every step that I take, I have to be careful that I'm not doing or saying anything that might go against, not their belief systems, because they are very liberal with like, do whatever you want to, but kind of they should be entertained as opposed to, I don't know who he's talking to. So if I make any political jokes, no one's going to get, because I don't think anyone, my family cares that deeply about politics. So naturally I don't go into it. Family is very silly, so I go into more absurd and silly spaces, which don't have, I would say, currently the most viral outlook as opposed to your thumbnail matters, right?
Yeah.
So as a live performer, I take that vibe on stage, saying that in the back of my head, if a camera is present, that means my family can probably see it. So it's still to entertain them in the back. They are my first line of audience, I would say.
You know, I asked you the ritual, and I think the thinking back on the people who... you value the most in so many ways is interesting, right? Because as much as, you know, especially in today's world, when you're creating content, everyone's creating content in some form. I think everyone's online. The tendency is look at the 100 people or 1,000 people or even like whatever, some people have a million plus people and saying that, oh, this is, I'm creating it for them. When you think back on it, in essence, you want to make sure that people who are core to you, who are your people, I heard someone use the term your tribe, that they still understand what you're doing and they not, I don't think agree, but it's like you make sure they're not like, what are you doing? Right.
Yeah.
Because that you need that to center yourself. You need that to maybe, I think sleep at night is a little hardcore, but just
yeah,
that
it's
to
a little
like,
hardcore. Yeah. Like I haven't done anything bad like that. I think I can sleep pretty well at night so far.
Yeah, because I've often thought about this, right? When you would create content, like on saying, how is someone going to react? And the tendency is always to go beyond those people closest to me. Or what will someone say? And what will someone think about something I said? What will someone think about this one photograph or this one tweet?
I don't have that issue.
No?
I'll tell you, I don't know. I don't have that issue.
How do you not have that issue?
Again, I've been on stage since that memory. So... from fancy dress, multiple fancy dress, to hosting events in school, church, colleges, mall, radio. Then doing radio, which is my... music in school was my first stint with, let's say, any kind of recognition. Other than that, popular in the church because my dad was a secretary, mom was an integral member of the church, my brother was also known. So known to be on stage.
Mm.
With radio, what it gave me was local popularity that people started recognizing. So I tasted popularity in school,
mm.
and then this happened. So for me, it has always been the audience in front. Online wasn't a thing, mm. right? It was live performances. That's it. That's all. Yeah. The audience in front. 10 shows that 100 people will convert into 1,000, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Math is bad.
yeah,
so I was like, that's my audience. And that audience used to have always my family in it because I was born and raised in Delhi. All of them were there.
Mm.
So subconsciously, this internet popularity spike was unknown.
Mm.
But now I realize where I failed in the middle of my career for me. Not failed, I would say struggled was, who am I making this for?
Hmm.
What will people say?
Yeah.
So I started making generic-ish enough material that will work everywhere,
yeah.
but wasn't personal enough to be as exciting for me.
Did it work? Did the content itself work when it was generic? Because one is, but does it work for you? The other is, does it work for...
I mean, does it matter? Does it work for others? I mean, I'll be honest, well right? answered. For so long, if you're known,
yeah.
You've done so much work before your stint with being in front of a camera.
Yeah.
None of what you're doing right now can cancel out the work that you've done that's impacted so far.
Yeah.
So in a way, does it matter who is the audience? It's the first line of people who will tell you, your friends and your family.
Mm.
And if they are laughing and happy, you will make another one.
Yeah.
The issue that I felt with and now that I'm getting out of is this. The question about views is a very integral part. Like even on our show, we have to
yeah.
weigh checks and balances. How would it happen? What would you do?
Mm.
And even for this, right? Like, you know, one of the things would be, I would much rather want the comments on this to be what they felt
yeah.
as opposed to millions of views that come in of saying, loved it, bro.
Yeah.
I'm like, that doesn't value yeah. as much as did it impact you? A lot of silent audience members are your audience members.
Yeah.
They just don't make their presence felt online. Live in the fact that there are people watching. Just do your job and keep your circle entertained.
Yeah.
Each person in that circle represents, let's say, 10,000 people's mindsets, right? So you're going there if you consistently grow.
Mm.
But if you're worrying about how will this be perceived, do it for the guests, not yeah. for yourself. Like if you were on my show, I'd be like, would this make you look good? If it makes me look any different, I'm fine. My circle is good.
Yeah.
So in a vague way, like a 1 minute, 40 second answer, I would yeah. say this is what I would think.
And there's a core learning in what you just said, right? Because as much as you might want to create for others,
hmm.
you need to innately be satisfied with what you're doing. Otherwise, you can't do it long term. It becomes a job per se.
Hmm.
But the other fact is that you're also not doing it just for you. Because like if you have a guest, you're trying to make your guest be shown in the best light. It is about them. It's not about you. Because you can very easily veer in that direction when you make it all about, oh no, I need to be satisfied.
Mm.
It's all about me.
Mm, yeah.
It's like everything. I'm the center of the universe. So yeah. it's this weird like seesaw
yeah.
of saying, I can't make it about everybody else also. I can't make it just about me also. How do I find that middle ground? Yeah. Which is what we're all kind of... When you choose to be on camera in front of people, I think even in general, like you're in a organization, you want to make a presentation.
Yeah.
The more you make it about, you know, people who walk into a meeting and say, so I think.
Yeah, immediately it's a red
flag. I want this. I'm like, do say we. No, yeah. I've been this person always sitting like I had a heavy breath happens inside me. Like
yeah.
say we, don't say I, you come with four people with you.
Yeah.
And it's that balance, right?
Man, I think you're saying the, like, this is exactly what was in my head. I think, I presume, we haven't met before, right? You know, mm. this is the first time we
actually sat and had a longer conversation today.
Yeah, today we're having a long conversation. We've always met at events, like, yeah. you know. So I think you seem like a very empathetic person. Like, you have, what I presume, and this is just an analogy, is somebody who's empathetic has a 360 camera on. Your presence, aware of everyone who's around.
Yeah.
Like if you're focusing on just yourself, it's like seeing it through a keyhole, yeah, right? That's yeah. the only perspective. Banda galat nahi hai.
Yeah.
Bandi galat nahi hai. Correct. Others are not, this is not them. It's just at that point, you just need to pull someone out to access what I call like a Valkyrie flying around. Keep an eye out. Is everyone comfortable?
Mm.
So if I'm invited for this podcast, I had no idea about what we're going to do, for example. I was like, of course, I like this guy.
Yeah.
So it would be interesting as well. So your responsibility to take care of the guest is inherent in your personality, which is why I would love to come and speak. But if I was invited for something else, I think I would have my guard slightly up. I'd be like, what are we talking about? What did they want to do? Especially if it's a Bollywood related thing.
Yeah.
So your 360 degree vision camera was on the first time I met you. And now that I came here, but that's not necessarily for everybody else.
No.
Because for a lot of people, they are right now getting visible through recognition online. I have been made visible by my parents, brothers, cousins, live audience coming in for some time. So I feel very visible on stage or in front of a microphone. But if I make it about myself, then I am not doing justice to the entire ecosystem that has gotten me to a position where I'm happy, which is a very odd place to be in.
You know, as you were talking, even before you said about being happy, so I've just started to study happiness technically as a course, right? I've started one of those things. And one of the first things I read was the fact that one of the fundamental things research has found, which seems very obvious, but research has found, is that as much as we go after so many things that find us happiness, the innate thing that gives us happiness is human connection. You have someone you can connect with at an intimate level, friends, family, relationship. And that is has been one of the biggest chunk. Everything else is fleeting. It's just like, you know, momentary points of joy.
Yeah.
But if you want to find happiness, and through this time we've been chatting, the good part the interesting part I've seen is that you keep bringing back this point of your family, right? And I think that's, which also shows, I feel that all your content, everything that you do, all those aspects kind of drill down to the fact that you are innately happy because your human connection part is taken care of, is my analysis. Me not trying to be Dr. Freud here, but I'm just like, that is my analysis.
Sigmund Freud.
Yes.
Right from the stuff that I do on stage, there's a bit. So I have a special called Whoop. Okay. Amazon Prime. It's out on. It's my first special I put out. But I've been doing stand-up since 2008 or 9, I think, I forgot. But so when I was putting my best foot forward, I was very analytical back then. Right? It was a different person. I'm a very different person now. And I was like, every joke needs to be analytical, beautifully crafted, blah, 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 but don't have the skill to really take it up a notch. A lot of negative self-talk. As such, so overcompensated with performance. But there was this, out of the hour, there is 20 minutes of material that I personally enjoy, which is very tough for me to see myself on screen. But this is not bad. And both these were related to my family in some way or the other. Whether it's my cousin, sisters, parents, brothers, like relationships. Those are the human connections. Everything else, as a comedian, was an observational comedy. So I was getting laughs. But I wasn't feeling good. I was feeling achieved. Cerebrally, I was like, kya likha hai tune? But some of these stories and some of these things make you feel good. And that's what I'm trying to chase now. I haven't perfected the art of it, but I think, do we ever perfect anything?
What's your relationship with wanting to be famous?
Again, such a great question. How do I say this without being arrogant? Boy, I peaked in popularity in school. Everything else is just bonus I'm living right now. Because in a school of 3,000 people, I was the lead vocalist of my rock band. Do you need anything else?
No.
Bro, do you know how cool I was? I was peaking. Like, I felt great. I was very driven. We had to win every competition. Every musician in our band was... Our music teacher, Sir Norman, was incredible. So he really generated this vibe of like confidence, who I'll be on stage with music. So music was my first forte before stand-up. My dad's a funny person. Just give him a whiskey in his hand. He doesn't even have to sip it. Just through osmosis, he'll be like...
I agree with his feeling also.
Just whiskey.
All the time.
And his first line of audience is mom. So sometimes when he cracks a joke, I might not laugh because, you know, I'm... This age group, we have a lot of hubris. Like, we are egoistic. We earn. Our self-validation comes from me. But at that age group, I'm presuming, I haven't lived there, is your immediate circle.
Yeah.
So mom will always laugh at what dad says, my pa says, which is odd because I'm like, maybe it's not the finest, but I've seen him do the same joke again. And my mom laughs again and again.
Mm.
It's that supportive ecosystem that exists. So if something so beautiful exists and that happens to me also, then I just want to make sure that I adhere to it. Like you, someone's giving you a spotlight, it's your responsibility to hold a, thermocall and reflect it to the audience a little bit as well. And my audience happens to be them. So I don't know if that answered your question.
I ask this also because that's again a trap, right? Is, and the more you look at the world today, everyone's trying so hard to be seen so much more.
Yeah.
But weirdly enough and sadly enough, one of the predominant messages and DMs I tend to get online is that when I respond to someone who just sent me a long message, and I just, even I do a thumbs up, they're just happy to be heard. And there's sometimes someone says, no, will you just like follow my account because that you have more followers, so you'll get me something. And when those things happen, I'm like, what are you doing this for? Like, you know, and I understand the drive to want to have more followers, have more, be more famous. But I think what you said is it distills it down to, again, go back to the base parts. What's going to make you happy? What's going to keep, it's not going to, it's not about being famous. It's like, do you enjoy what you're doing? Is it taking care of your needs from a financial perspective or life perspective? Because, and it's not to take away the financial one, but at some point it's about that. I don't know. I call it a vibe. I think I can't think of a better word than vibe, which kind of brings all of this together. Which then brings me to saying, since everything you asked, you've had interesting response to it, what do you fear the most?
I think the fear is interesting. I fear that I might cannibalize myself in, like I might be my worst enemy when it comes to growth. Because I, like I'm aware that back in the day, if self-sympathy is the way that I used to feel recognized, I will crave sad moments so that I can come across as the, as like, oh my God, something bad has happened to me. After that, when I speak to everyone, I'm like, no one did me wrong. I just chose that perspective.
Yeah.
And it took some kind of like a, like it took some life events for me to be like, okay, this, you are at fault. Nobody else is. And imagine at that time when I was living and I was very confident that I was done wrong. It's, it shakes your foundation. Mm. Like, you know, it shakes you like sleep at night.
Yeah.
I'm able to sleep at night because now I know, okay, you're also at fault. And sometimes I feel this treading the line between modesty, self-criticism and overconfidence and arrogance. I hope I'm able to still have people around me who tell me where I am at. Because currently, if I'm kept alone in a room, I wouldn't know if I'm good or bad. It's like my confidence is like a Schrodinger's confidence, like Schrodinger's cat. It's in a box. You don't know if it's there or not. Till someone else doesn't say, hey, that was pretty good. We just shot an episode of Son of a Beach. The opening rap I was very nervous about. So we decided to do it live. And I was like, it's going to be cringe. It's going to be cringe. And I think that became my major fear, that I hope it's not bad. And in that attempt of it's not bad, I will over rehearse and not even look at, I don't want it to be good. I just don't want it to be bad, which is a wrong metric to be at. So I'm trying to flip that. But imagine if I'm flipping that on this angle, life, which is like a 360, what else am I not mindful about? So my biggest fear is that I do wrong by to someone without realizing. Interesting fun fact. When I watch rom-com films, there is a when you watch any rom-com film, there is a part in every rom-com film where the guy or the girl will mess up, and then it's the chase to convince. You know that airport final chase. I love you. I was wrong. I skip that part, or I watch the rom-com till there, and then I'm like, I hate miscommunication. Everyone is good, and I get really afraid in case I find out there is genuine, purely vindictive and vile, that I haven't encountered in my vibe yet. I'm very afraid if I'm just ignorant.
I have this feeling when those parts happen in rom-coms. Whenever something's going wrong in a movie or a story, you know, I feel this innate, almost like this physical feeling of like, I want to not want to see this. I want to skip this. I want to leave. I've never articulated the way you just did it. because I always said, okay, maybe I'm just uneasy. Like, I don't watch horror movies because I'm like, just why would I have to put myself through that? Like, that is not enjoyable for me in any way. Why would I put myself through that? Because I just generally feel uneasy. But this is a different kind of uneasy. It's like, you know, something's going wrong and you're like, I don't want to experience it.
Yeah.
But what you said makes more interesting sense than what I always felt. I always felt that it was because I innately am averse to things going wrong in general or anything which is uneasy. Because I like things to be, like, I used to be a brush it under the carpet person, which I'm less and less of now.
Hmm.
And I thought it was that. But what you just said makes a lot more sense from context than how I always looked at it.
Empathetic, right? I feel like with rom-coms, there's an immediate connection of what if it's true. With horror, there's a sense of suspended disbelief.
Yeah.
You can choose to be like, it's in a film. But if it's a rom-com, you want to be, like, there is a little bit of relatability because they play with the strings of the heart and love and all of that. So when that happens, you're like,
how could you do this?
Yeah, and that discomfort makes me uncomfortable till today. But like a horror discomfort, like this, you know, champion dying on the field of battle. I'm like, oh, this is great. And based on true story, I'm like, oh, that is good. A fictional work where a guy just messed up or a girl messed up goes deeper than actually finding out this happened. So I think that it's probably, maybe because you're a high empath, I'm presuming.
I'm hoping. I oftentimes think about that. Because I feel we all veer towards being self-centered and having empathy. And I have that range. But I feel that the more you work on yourself, you almost figure out when you're in which side. And you almost like self-correct before that actually happens. Because the tendency is a lot in that way. Because you also realize, right? Like, well, you know when you're doing something that's very off. Let's admit it. It's just that we don't give ourselves the time to, and not to plug the name of the show, to
that's
pause.
Exactly.
And say that, one second, I'm being a douche.
Yeah, I think because we continue to keep doing without actually having any retrospective.
You're digging yourself deeper. You're going deeper instead of trying to get out of that hole.
Yeah.
And say, oh, let me sort it out. Let me go in. Let me lie. Let me figure a way to answer this. Let me first instinct, point the finger at someone else. Second instinct is, I this is the entire series, right? I forget. Where you first point the finger at someone else, then you go into self-victim mode. Then you get angry. Then you go sad, and eventually you come to realize. But you can actually choose, if I remember that order right, but you can choose to skip that and say, one second. Pooja, my wife and I, we joke about this, right? Because both of us have spent enough time doing this over the last 3-4 years. So our arguments are like therapy sessions. So if I'll say something and she'll say, you know, this you're saying it like this, do you realize this? And I'm like sitting, I'm like, no, but I've reflected on what I just said. So it becomes that. It's not a full blown out. Even if it is a full blown out thing, in the first like 5-10 minutes, we are like. So our biggest joke is that it becomes therapy mode whenever we're having an argument.
I think that's a great learning for anyone in any kind of conversation, any relationship, romantic, business, or crew wise also, is to, you know what you just said, like point the finger. I can put this across and like, you put it up really nicely in words, but for me, every time something goes off, it'd be like, oh, shit, it's me. So if there is, in a relationship or in any fight, what I find odd is the thing that you will not let me finish a sentence. Or I will not let you finish a sentence. Or I will overspeak. And pause and silence in an actual emotionally wound up conversation is so against nature of like, but you said this, but you said this then, but you said this then.
Yeah.
That I think that is a good learning that I should take back with anybody as such, which is allow silence to remain in conversations. Because you're still conversing in the silence of it, whether it's introspective, whether it is taking a break from a moment, but it requires a ton of maturity. Like, you know, I don't think I'm that mature.
The point is to like slowly add that. And that has been my like, because I'm very self-critical as a person. And my tendency has always been to say, but I can't be that mature. I can't do this. And the only learning I've had is that, you know, you just need to be able to add like 5%, 1% whenever you can. You'll never come to 100%. Like, I'm very childish in general. Like at home, everybody has to deal with a lot of like this one grown-up child around the house. Because I'm like, I'm finicky about the most random of things. I will randomly have like a tantrum. But my tantrum is I'll go off and sit in a room. And I will calm myself down. And then I'll come back out. I was that kid who would get angry with his parents and go sit in the room.
Great.
Shut the door and not play with my toys by myself. Like, I'm like, that was my like way to kind of distress.
Yeah, I don't remember being angry at anyone at family because I've been the youngest, right?
Yeah.
So I know that if I do some kind of punishment would come through.
Yeah.
I would presume.
Mm.
Have you seen me? I mean, now the dynamics change, right? Now that I'm in my hubris, 35-year-old man, and they are 75, I'm earning. You know, it's me. I'm taking care of you. Like my elder brother also, he takes care of them. Like they are in Canada now. My brother lives there. So he's single-handedly taking care. So as the youngest son, I'm like, what am I doing? If I have a podcast, I'm like, you come along. Two chairs will be available anyway. And they're already so low maintenance. Do you think I have a... How do I express anger? Any anger? Have I shown anger?
You don't remember him expressing his anger.
I'm 100% sure I don't yell or scream. I have one trait though. That's a good point actually, come to think of it. I go cold and I go very professional, very cutthroat, very Excel sheet, very formal. That's my exit.
It's your tell.
That's my tell of I'm out. Like I've checked out. I can't go into a room. Because physically, if
you
I remove
closed.
My... Yeah, the thing is, no? To, in a...
Man, we do the same things.
We do the same things? Oh, wow. It's great. One day, I shall have this set up. Either you and wearing white linen that fits as opposed to green linen that once fit. And now it's a jacket. I think the one thing that I do and I regret and I would want to change that is that at a point that I am extremely disappointed... or angry, I don't know the difference sometimes. Because the thing is, if I get angry, my first instinct is, tune bhi kuch galat kiya hoga. Right? That
which is fabulous, because that's like a late realization for most people.
That realization is from the very beginning, because my parents, like literally they're very deeply religious. Deep religious upbringing has two effects. One is you go against it. And I can choose that. But instinctively, I can't. Because if that's what defines them and I love them, then A is equal to B, B is equal to C, A equal to C.
Yeah.
So in that is where my home is at. Like I feel comfortable. So before blaming someone, I would be slightly like, I don't know. I'm not sure. Because confidence of being angry is confidence, no? You're angry at someone. I mean, you're confident about it. But I'm so underconfident that what if I'm at fault?
Yeah.
And you always heard, Tali don haath se basti hai.
Correct.
Religious upbringing of like, you know, forgive, you know. So if your final eventual goal after anger, fight, is to forgive, skip that entire part and just forgive immediately. And then you start introspecting. So when you have no one else to blame, you start pointing all fingers at yourself. Which is the opposite end of the spectrum, which I wish I did not do when I was a kid. It's become so inherent that, Varun, how do I tell you? It becomes so tough to not make a self-deprecatory joke because I mastered the art of some really good burns at myself.
Yeah.
But now I can't just depend on that. So the anger is inwards, and the inward anger... comes out not on other people by loudness, but in the lack of any decibel at all. Just quiet, professional, and calm. And I don't know if I recognize calm with like a good thing or a sense of patronizing tone. So that is what I think my way of showing anger is, which I wish it's much more toxic than it is.
Yeah. Also, like, because you go the direction of self-deprecating because you don't want to seem like you're pompous in any way. So you're overcorrecting.
Yeah.
And somewhere in between. And I feel that's the thing. Right? Everything in life is about the balance, right? Because you either veer one side or the other, and over time you kind of figure out how to kind of...
Yeah.
It's like trying to ever learn surfing or trying to ever learn to balance. Like, for me, that childhood memory of the seesaw.
Yeah.
where you're not, if you're not sitting on either side, you stand, you are that weird kid who stands in between and tries to balance
the
both
together. Have you held it?
Try to do that and you can never do it. That is everything we do, right? Everything in life. You just try to like make sure you balance that whole piece out.
I don't think I've learned that balance yet, to be honest, but yeah.
I don't think it's possible to learn it. You will veer and you will have moments and periods when you do it and then you will fall one side and you'll fall the other side and you should be just, you should just be okay with that has been my bigger learning, at least.
Like they say in meditation also, right? Like when you're meditating, your brain might wander off.
Mm.
But instead of going, and come back, you know that, this is what I want to segue smoother.
Mm.
I think I've been living my life like a IO and delete from Premiere Pro. And then it's suddenly it's a jump cut. And you're like, I wish I could, you know, segue in, like crossfade from one thing to another, which is what meditation helps in, is to not to do that. Yeah. And that I have learned from, let's say, my father's behavior, right? Which is very analytical, very perfectionist. So always working, always hyperworking.
Mm.
So sitting down to take a pause is not natural unless it's a crash.
Mm.
My mom is the opposite. My mom would want to enjoy life more. She wants to do what she likes.
Mm.
So there are both sides that I've seen. Both are contradicting to each other. But it's my responsibility. If he's on this side of the seesaw, she's on this side of the seesaw, I need to figure that kid of what I want.
Mm.
But that comes to my first question answer, which is, I'm afraid if I'm not mindful of it, naturally, I'm leaning to one side.
Mm.
And that balance, I'm not able to maintain.
Mm.
Amongst many things, my reference point is always going to be pa, ma, elder brother, and cousins and everyone around. Mm. So in those reference points, the two major points are these guys.
Mm.
So in case of a bad relationship, I know I could take up one of those traits that they have because maybe they haven't figured the balance. Maybe it's in the corner. And I feel like that might affect somebody else way worse. Like I might not burst out, but if I'm disappointed, isn't that worse?
Yeah.
It's like I'm not breaking a relationship. I'm making it become rust before it breaks. Like those are toxic traits that I would wish I could relearn. I mean, wish I could remove.
Mm.
Hopefully I have worked on it as well so that it saves everyone's time as well.
Does that also make you look at things and say that, do you give up easily?
Not at all. I don't think I've given up. I don't think I've given up. That's something I... Could you ask me a little more deeper? Yeah. Because right now I'm saying, of course, I haven't given up. I'm like,
let me put this way. And because you mentioned relationships, and I think that's an important one to pick up, is that be it relationships, which is, I think, one of the core things we all tend to give up on, especially when we're younger. You know, give up on someone you're with, etc. You also tend to give up on relationships with family in many people's cases.
Yeah.
But you also tend to give up on things you want to do in life. Okay, it's too hard to do, or I will fail anyway. And that seeps in and becomes a broader thing. So in that sense of the word, do you give up on things?
I'm going to break it down from this. I love doing music. My first skill that I learned was, first was dancing and acting, but like music was the first thing that made me feel good.
Mm.
And I used to be a musician before I did radio or comedy or anything. I till today try to write songs with no ambition of release, with no ambition of projecting a new career path. I haven't given up on music, so which is pretty good. Let's talk religion, for example. I believe in God and I'm very specific about my faith, but it's endothermic, not exothermic. Mm. Like you don't need to feel the heat or the cold of it. It's just internal. I haven't given up on that. Lots of failed relationships, friendship and romantic. I still pride myself over the fact that I am friends with all of them, except for maybe two or three, but that's their choice because I make them uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that eats me up each day. I'm like, I made someone uncomfortable. That wasn't my intention of it. But again, I might have made them uncomfortable. Could have been my fault. And it should be something I need to reflect and solve. But I really feel, and I said this in Discoveries also, people are not stones you throw into the ocean. People are boomerangs you throw. They'll swing back one day if you live long enough. And when you do end up meeting, catching up, every atom of your body has changed by that time.
Yeah.
So would you hold yourself accountable to that? Mm. It's like removing art from the artist. But in this case, it's just human behaviors. So I would say, yeah.
The only thing I'd say that I don't think you don't give up on people who are also partially saying, okay, I want to not continue this the way it was.
Hmm.
I feel you outgrow certain people in the sense that, you know, you're friends with some people at certain points of time in life.
Hmm.
And I feel that happens in the middle period of your life. Like you meet friends from when you were in school or even like college, you're fine. Like that, you pick up exactly where you left off. Like my closest friends today are still the same bunch I hung out with in college. Right. But it's the people you meet when you first start working or when you know, that first set, those are partly professional, partly this. And though some of them might go sideways, as long as you reflect and say, okay, what did I maybe not do right?
Yeah.
The rest of it, I feel, is something that happens and doesn't happen. But I like the boomerang analogy because I feel that in some ways also tells you that it's never really, oh, this is done in most cases. And that's a good way to look at it in your own head because you're not putting that pressure of a full stop or that pressure of like, oh my God, will this like kind of come back at some point? You don't want to be that also.
Absolutely. I think rightfully so. Like it's like your pause and play friendships.
Mm. Yeah.
We meet at events.
Yeah.
It's immediate play.
Yeah.
And then you pause because you get busy with work. I get busy with work.
Yeah.
But next time we meet, it's a play.
Yeah.
I do that with my friends, Jubin, who's a friend of mine from church as well. He keeps calling me all the time. Anytime he's free and I don't answer, I feel bad. And he's like, bro, I'm calling you because I know you're busy.
Yeah.
Jab te par time answer kar liyo.
Exactly.
So I will call him back maybe a day or two later. I'm like, yeah. Oh, now then he might be busy.
Yeah.
So there is a way of like, we're checking in with missed calls till we get time.
Yeah.
So those kind of relationships are very light because it doesn't come with guilt.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, arre main tereko phone kiya tha, maine wapas kyun nahi kiya? That is where I'm like, I don't know if this can be pause and play because it'll require a lot more play than pause. And right now I need pause on that because I'm play at work right now.
Yeah, and you can't be there with there for everyone all the time, right? Because I was chatting with someone the other day and I have a tendency to say, oh, I'll come back to you on this or I'm going to ping you soon. I say ping very often. So I don't know why I don't not use that. I use that word a little too much. And he said that, you know, you don't have to keep saying that because you know you won't.
Now that's a close friend to keep.
And, Leia gonna and I was like, that's true. I just say it because I feel it's nicer to say that. He said, don't be nice. Just say that I'm not going to be able to call you back or I don't want to do this.
Hmm.
And this happened like literally yesterday. And I was like, that's actually a valid point because I tend to want to be nice. But then you're leaving that person saying, okay, this guy will never call me back. I'll have to just keep pestering him till he does that. I don't do that with everybody. I feel in my head, the people I believe in a long fade out rather than a cut. So I'm like, I'm just fading out, which is a very like wimpy way to do it in many cases, especially if you're friends or if you are connected to them. And I know that I have to learn that a lot more. But like he called me out and I'm like, I agree with you. This is not what I should do.
Okay, I have a question to you. Mm. Okay, this is more. Can you say no easily to people?
No.
How do you... I feel this issue almost on a daily basis. And that's where most amount of my time and my brain space goes in when it should be going to things that don't stress me out. Is how do you say no without coming across as arrogant, अरे ये तो आगे निकल गया है, और अरे ये तो, like you know that thing that I was saying that I don't care about what people think.
Mm.
Online is fine, but if I know someone in that pause play or someone who I've met before, and I can't say no, and it becomes very hectic, so I do the same thing, long ass fade out.
Yeah.
Very long as fade out. They texted, you kept it unread for 2 days and you read it.
Don't open that WhatsApp message. Do not leave that blue button there.
Yeah, though. Oh, and then like half the time unread. I have like 6 or 7 unread messages that have lasted for the last 2 weeks now. And one of them I have to respond to, but I'm like, I don't know how, what. So I'm waiting for the next ping. And when the next ping happens, I have to respond. I'll be
so
too late.
I learned something yesterday of a random Instagram post someone shared. And I want to try it. Saying that I really want to figure a way to do this with you, but right now I don't have the mental energy or the physical bandwidth to do it.
All the best. I want to see you try. I want to see you try and regret that decision that on very my face moment.
For saying that. But I'm still trying to find. So I've learned to say no to, like, before I would not say no to anybody. Now I learned to say no to, like, you know, someone said, do you want to give a quote for some publication? No. Do you want to come for this event? No. I'm just saying my schedule is full. I've thankfully now I can say that and people are like, okay, maybe it must be. My schedule is full because I want to be home, play with my kids. But that is, for me, schedule is full.
Can I tell you something though? Sorry to break your flow. Jose said something on Journey of a Joke, which was incredible. Okay. It was a very defining moment for me because till that time, same thing, busy. Calendar was super stacked. And he came, he came in with a bread roll and he was eating and on the shoot. And he's like, and we were talking about his craft and comedy. And one thing that he said is like, yeah, I want to stay home with my family. And every time I think of an idea, can I do it in the next 5 minutes? Only then do I even approach it. So I asked, one of the things we didn't put on the edit, but I asked him was, so like when someone is called, like we called you for it, it's like, I'll see if I'm free, I'll come. Mm. And he says that, and which is the simplest way, I'll see if I'm free, I'll come.
Yeah.
But I wish I had that.
But like, you know, the problem with that is, I've said that too, but people follow up.
Yeah.
What do you do when they're messaging, I hope you're coming today? You can't then say, I'll see, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I realized that I think you have to go through the cycles of saying no. You say no to things, people who you're not that connected with, so you can say that no.
Hmm.
Then you can also kind of, In those cases, I don't think you even have to explain too far. Like, you don't have to explain, oh, this is the reason why I'm saying no. But when it's a little more personal, I feel at some point you have to learn to be honest at the right time. There was this interesting thing. I was watching a video by Simon Sinek and he said that honesty is important, but doesn't have to be immediate. He said that he had a friend who had a stage performance and that performance was very bad wasn't the best, but he met that person after and he said, you know, I'm so happy to see you on stage doing what you've done right now. Right. And he didn't go deeper into that and he walked away. And the next day he called up and said, okay, because he's like, this person had that surge of, I've just gotten off stage, have that energy there. And now I don't want to burst that bubble when it's fully blown up.
Yeah.
The next day, when that's deflated a little bit, come back to normalcy, he's like, okay, now, can I tell you what I really thought?
Hmm.
I thought it's a very interesting way to do it. Again, sounds very good in theory. I don't know how practical it is, but I feel it might work.
But you imply it, right? You just said, let me get back to you.
Hmm.
Let me ping you back. Hmm. You already done the first step of it.
I just don't ping
you. You just don't do the follow-up that others do.
I'm like, I feel the emotion behind that is more a sound. It's like, it's that.
I also feel like there's moral superiority if someone asked me to come for a show. If I was in the same situation and someone said, what do you think about the show? I don't want to say anything then or even later until they message the second time, like, hey, I really want to know. Because giving feedback is such a high moral superiority thing that it feels, not moral superiority, it just feels like you're in a position of power, right? And it's an odd feeling to be at a position of power that your words might not have any impact, but you suddenly are like, oh no, I have to give feedback. As opposed to just be like, what did you think of the show? As an industry expert in stand-up, if someone's making a show and they're like, hey, this is the edit of it, please give us feedback. I'm like, you said feedback. So inherently, you're going to get feedback and not what's good. But because I work with my crew and I realize it comes across too cutthroat, right? So now my feedback starts with a paragraph of what I really enjoyed and smaller bullet points of, let's discuss this when we can.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. We shot the pilot. I think Vivian was in the same thing. We shot the pilot and our director, Dinkar, and I, we both were like, I want to talk to the crew. So what I did was I took screenshots of shots, time-coded it, wrote down feedback that I need to present. And now I showed it to Dinkar. Dinkar was like, okay, got it. But he said, I will communicate that. And he was able to express not my feedback, but like, these were great shots that were good. Next time we can maybe pan in a little bit, feel a little bit more. Something I would have taken 30 minutes of like extensive feedback, which have change the vibe.
Mm.
He was able to do it very quickly. He's like, this is great. Let's just do it. I'm guessing these guys have a good time as well.
Mm.
That's an unlearning and new learning for me, which is like, just because someone asks you feedback doesn't mean you need to be like, you know, to make it perfect, what do you need to do? As opposed to, if you do it once, what should you do the next time?
Mm.
Not what you should do a year, like how it should ideally be. Mm. It should just be, what should you do next time according to you? Because then the third show and the fourth show, fifth show will figure. You mm. just need to give feedback or like your opinion for what they should do next, yeah. not for what they should do in a year's time.
Basically, perfect can ruin a good vibe. So I think a good vibe is more important than perfect in many ways, right?
Absolutely.
Because, and I feel we over-index on it needs to be perfect, needs to be good. But if everybody just feeling like, oh my God, why am I doing this? Or this is just like painful, then what's the point of doing it? I mean, the end result might look better, but I feel only you will notice it.
Yeah.
The general person won't.
That's what I do. I write down all the feedback now and I don't send it on the day. So on my laptop, not even on cloud, on my laptop on stickies, I write down what I think and I'll minimize it and I will revisit it when it's needed and I'll just take out the things that's needed and probably try to communicate in conversation because in text I'm very cutthroat because words don't, I don't pride myself of being a good writer. I pride myself of being a good orator. So if I'm a good orator, my writing won't represent empathetically what I want to put through or it'll take so much more effort. So I would much rather just tell them in those bullet points.
What's the best piece of advice you ever gotten?
A good piece of advice I got recently was don't shoot everything on 4K.
very valid advice whoever gave that to you.
That's a good advice on life also, to be honest. I think human beings always think success or growth is additive. Sometimes success, growth is also subtractive, if that's a word. So, of course, you can get all the things, stuff it up. But if you remove all the things, there's a sense of, you feel more emotions. I won't say happiness. So, yeah, try reducing. Reduce, remove, subtract. And spend time not doing anything. It's a weird thing to say. I've seen a lot of videos where I can tell you that they scientifically put down why you should not do anything. The power of boredom. Books are written about it. And I never subscribed to it because, like I said, my dad's personality is to always do. And in doing, there's visibility. There is who you are. If you don't do, then who are you? You're nobody. Like, you're defined by what you do. Your inactivity doesn't add to anything, which I think is incorrect. The inactivity adds so much. Reflection, introspection, your next move. If you work on your next idea, you might miss out on your best idea. You know who said that? Abish Matthew. What up, bro?
But actually, that's true. I so agree on the subtraction part. It's such an important one. What's your idea for a relaxing day?
When the camera's off, I'll tell you.
Okay,
when the camera's on, when the camera's on, an idea of a good relaxing day is a day where I'm not looking at my Google calendar of what is my next appointment.
I feel that. What's a song that lifts your mood?
Oh, I'll tell you a series of songs. I have a... So every time I feel a little low, there is a playlist I've created that just has...
Is it a public playlist?
No, not a public playlist. There are... There's a song I've written, okay? It's called Average Melody Song. Released in 2011 or 13 or something. Before I moved to Bombay. No, I don't know. But basically wrote it when I was in radio back in Delhi. It's called Average Melody Song. It's a song that I wrote for myself of how to feel better. And then I forgot about it. And I released it many years later, just on SoundCloud. It's not anywhere else. You can't find it anywhere. It's got only, like a few people I know have commented on it. Till today, when I listen to that track, it's not good. I like it. I like the melody of it. It has a story to it. The guitar part is from Matthew Jacob, who's a friend of mine. The music melody came from Johan Pace, who's the bass player. Then Adhir played guitars on it. Ani from Advaita did the arrangement. There's a full narrative. It took a few years for that song to make. And now when I listen to it, it literally is just advice to myself of how to feel better. And I find it so odd now at 35 that back then I wrote a song that still today is the song that I listen to and be like, okay, what should I do if I'm feeling jittery, nervous, or not even nervous, if you're not feeling well, if your mind is not well, That's one song I listen to. Other than that, there is a vibe of a song I listen, which is not but it's got to have a good, happy melody.
Yeah.
So I think I would say average melody song, the song that I wrote for myself, that's the song I listen to. And after that, I listen to more whatever is like a happy vibe of a song.
But thank you so much for doing this, man. It's just been fabulous. I'm happy we could do this in this space, in the way we did it, with your parents around.
Yeah.
Man, you couldn't have asked for more.
I know. And thank you for having me.